talking to Lauren Rush in Woodside, California, just around the corner from the Jurassy Foundation, on the date is Wednesday, the 26th of October.
Right. Well, after all that conversation about other things, attempt to cast your mind back in history to what you remember about your early relationships with KPFA and with KPFA music programming.
Okay, well, I just kind of try to do it chronologically from my experience. And that I came to KPFA in about, I think it was just maybe the fall of 56. Mm-hmm. And
who was the music director?
And it was, I was hired by Alan Rich on the recommendation of my teacher, Robert Erickson. And I was making my living as a jazz pianist and going to school at the time, which is a good thing because it wasn't quite a job. It was half-time job of 1950s payment, you know, for an assistant to Alan Rich at the time. And Erickson put me there because he wanted, for my training. Because even though at that time I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, he thought that for the kind of musical training I needed was what I would get from Alan Rich.
Everyone has told me in one way or another that Bob Erickson was a sort of eminence grise behind the music department over a long period of time, which did not consist merely of the time when he was the music director.
Yes, apparently he wasn't there very long as music director, but he stayed, and I think he was on the board of directors for quite a while.
He cast a very long shadow.
Yeah. And so not only did I have this association with the kind of knowledge and musical taste that Alan Rich had and shared, but Alan asked me to do the live concerts because of my experience as a performer and the fact that I knew most of the performers in the area very well and could get on with them, and I think that he was just a little bit uncomfortable around performing musicians in that regard, especially since he was also a critic at the time. And, so it kind of made a nice separation. So he would do the live concert announcements, such as the remotes, which we did a lot of in those days, and for which he was pretty famous for, in his. The way he did those and so on.
There was a permanent tie line, I remember, to Hertz Hall on the campus.
Yeah, and so he would typically announce those, or he'd do the Carmel Bach Festival and those things. But when they were actually produced KPFA studio concerts, then that came to be my job. And in those days, you'd not only produce them, but you would either write the script or announce them.
Yeah. And Aptus came a few years later, didn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah. I didn't have any experience with that. And so I got to work with generally Alan would schedule them. And then as time went on, I started scheduling as I got the people and then play ones that I liked and I'd play, then I'd schedule them for a return performance and so on. And I think that we were all working for, in those days, for something like $8 a concert.
It was the absolute minimum that the musicians' union
would allow for a radio, since they didn't. That was the only. Well, there had been radio earlier on, commercial radio, but at that time, I think it was the only thing going on in radio. For live music and I think it raised to $12 by the time I left. I was only there for 2 years, officially, and then I continued an association that led into other events.
Everybody recycles mm-hmm. that station periodically.
And so, there was already, at the time that I was there, there had already been established from the beginning, as far as I know, or as soon as possible, the live music aspect of it. And that was mainly my job. And I really, really enjoyed that. We worked on trying to get, that was my first experience in trying to produce high quality sound.
Right. Did you have an engineer working with you?
We had a
miking engineer.
We had a young engineer named James Cano.
Ah, Jimmy Cano, right? Yeah, yes. He was also Elsa Knight Thompson's a production person as well. And preceded George Craig, who, a similar young man who came in.
Yes, and then I worked with George Craig, but later, after I was not officially with KPFA. And so I think he did most of the work. And then there was also Stephen Hawes, but he wasn't quite as involved as much as Jimmy Cano.
Yeah. Steve was more of a transmitter engineer than a recording engineer.
And so I kind of learned got my first experience really using professional microphones from Jimmy Cano. And then after a while I got so that I learned how I like to mic the piano and how I like to do the voices, and so I got into it. So I would do my own miking as part of the production.
One was working mono in those days.
Yeah, and actually, to this day, I see this side thing, but not that anyone ever would want to listen to mono. But the reason stereo doesn't work is too often it's two copies of mono, and so it's and now people do go back and listen to all historical recordings in mono, and they play the same channels as two speakers and so on. And so much of my experience was this very musical experience of having the musicians come in, doing this, sort of giving the warm up, getting the technical session, getting the mic, and getting them ready to go on, finding out what their program. Generally, we try to do the program in advance, but it often wasn't done. Hopefully, getting a script written, because at those times we use scripted announcers for almost everything. And the failure to get the script written would be that you'd have to do it yourself. And then the model for doing it improvising, the comparison was Alan Rich. So
formidable.
Yeah, so I really worked hard to try to get those scripts done. But a lot of times it wasn't possible. And I developed an awkwardness in front of microphones that's with me to this day because of that experience. Even like this, I'm not too happy about being connected to a microphone because of that very traumatic thing. Also, I was about the young, other than Jimmy Cano, I was about the youngest person there. And then there were the KPFA political things that were going on at that time, which I had almost no perspective except being totally confused by even what the issues might have been. As soon as I got there, people were already choosing up sides. There was something that was going on between Lou Hill and Schultz.
Bob Schutz.
Schutz.
Yeah.
And they were choosing sides, and they were wanting you to be on this side, and I didn't know what they were doing. And I never did find out what that was all about, actually.
Yeah, I know you said it on tape, but tell me again the date when you first came on.
I think it was in the fall of 56.
Right. That would have been close to the end, because Lou Hill committed suicide in first of August 57.
Okay, so it was after that. So I hadn't been there very long, and one of the first things that happened to me when I was at KPFA is that I got laid off. I don't know how long. Maybe you'd been there a month or two. That was one of my first meetings with Lou Hill. Mm-hmm. And and he called me into his office, and he was explaining the financial problems. I understand later what was going on. At the time, I didn't. But not only that, but I really didn't understand what he was talking about. I mean, this. I thought I was pretty old at the time, but now I look back and I was just turned 21. And it really. That wasn't enough for me to be able to communicate with Lou Hill.
Do you have any abiding impressions of Lou Hill as a person, as a personality?
I have. I remember him not very much. You know, for one thing, it was I was sort of like on the level of Jimmy Cano running around the place, so really was not a lot of interaction. And the other thing was, that I was totally absorbed in just doing the music. But I do remember this very wonderful meeting that I had where he laid me off after I'd been there for 2 months. And for me, it wasn't a big financial thing because I wasn't making enough to make any difference. And I had plenty of piano jobs on the weekends and so on, so I was doing okay. And there was this very, the guy did speak, he was a poet and he spoke as a poet. And there was this continuous stream of poetry as he was explaining to me that because of the financial conditions, I would have to take a leave of absence. And they would bring me back as soon as they could. What I had to do is, after the meeting, I had to go to Alan Rich and ask him, what was that all about? What did he just tell me? Because I kind of got the feeling like he was telling me that I wasn't going to be there for a while, but I wasn't sure, even too sure about what that was. You know? Or was I totally fired, or what was the thing? You know? And so that was one of my early experiences with him. And then I guess I was gone for 2 or 3 months, and then I came back on again. And I stayed there for 2 years, a total of about 2 years. The reason, and it developed into I was having a great time except for the politics. There's always crazy politics going on. And it was not just that I didn't have an interest in it. I really couldn't understand what it was about. And to this day, I don't know what that was about. I didn't have enough interest to even find out, apparently.
You are not alone.
Oh, well, but there are people that think they know. I really know that I don't know. And I was a graduate student in the music department at Berkeley at the time, as were, as far as I know, all of the music assistants through history, that came in there. As long as they were having them, as long as I remember anyway. And I was also, after 2 years, I was in the Berkeley Music Department. I'd been there for 2 years, and the Selective Service was getting after me because they figured that a 2-year deferment for a master's was plenty long enough. And I was convinced I was going to be drafted, you know, this. So I told Alan that it just looks like, you know, I pushed this as far as I can. They're going to draft me, and I'm going to be out of here. You
know? We're looking Korean War at this point.
It was after the Korean War. This was 57, 58.
But it was
really,
then.
But it was right. Really difficult to stay out of the Army mm-hmm. in those days. I don't know what they were doing, but for some reason they were drafting everybody they could. Anyway, I remember it was a really big concern. It was very difficult to do that, to stay out. And I was determined I wasn't going in, but I didn't see how, you know, whatever happened, I wasn't going to be able to stay on KPFA. And so I gave Alan this warning about it. And then Bob Erickson then introduced Alan to Glenn Glassow. And that's how we got to Glenn Glassow. So Glenn Glassow came in and showed up on the job, you know, and a really marvelous man and did a great job and eventually, as you know, became the music director after Alan left. Something that I would have never been able to have done, both for lack of experience and lack of comfort with microphones and a lot of other a lot of other things. But the curious thing was that I didn't get drafted. So I just sat there and talked myself out of a job was what I did. And I really loved the job, you know, and I really loved working with the people. And that was so but soon the time came Glenn shows up and
But you continued to have a peripheral relationship
oh,
with
very
the station
much.
Over a long period.
Because of maybe a more creative relationship after I left, because of the friendships that were developing with Glenn at the time, and then I managed. Then what I did is I did get extended through the draft for another year, and then I got from the University of California, I got what was called the Prix de Paris, which is a prize to go to just work in Paris for 2 years, not to study or to do anything.
And who gave that?
And that was done by the University of California, the music department. But it's the university, it's supposed to be wide open, University of California. I don't think anybody ever received it that wasn't a student at Berkeley. Because the committee was always made up of Berkeley faculty. I don't know how that worked. But but as I noticed from before my time and from after, it seemed like they all came from Berkeley. And, I mean, it's not a rare thing to have if you happen to be a Berkeley composer because every 2 years somebody gets it. Mm-hmm. So that time it was my turn. And so I was there for 2 years, and I didn't get drafted during that 2 years. And by the time I got out, I was too old to be drafted, or I was put in the lowest category, so I never had to deal with that. But that's why I left KPFA, which is I probably have the only benign reason for leaving KPFA of anybody I know.
Yeah, one of the very few that were not tarred and feathered and carried out on a rail.
Or certainly at that time. You know, there are other... Mm-hmm.
You know. But then when you returned, you had programmatic, musical association.
Then when I returned, I think by that time, then Will Ogden had been appointed music director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Will came after Glenn Glassow and before Charles Scheer.
Yes, who was also brought in by Robert Erickson. Mm-hmm. Not only Charles Scheer, but Will Ogden and Glenn Glassow and me before that. Now, I think after that, I think Charles actually hired somebody himself that Robert Erickson didn't personally recommend. But,
well, actually, Charles told me that if I remember correctly, that he did. There was consultation with Bob Erickson about Charles Amerikanian.
Yeah, but there was some assistance that he at that time. They still had assistants, and I think Charles did hire his own assistant. But even before then, the assistants were. It was pretty much
yes,
the,
because the, yeah. Will had a young assistant who wanted to take over, but was too young. Peter Winkler.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. And Charles came in, and Peter remained as an assistant to Charles.
So I think at some point it became a little bit more autonomous. but up until about the time up through. Charles's appointment, I think it was pretty much Erickson's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my God, what a track record.
Yeah. It worked in the past, and so they kept doing it as long as he was in touch, I think. And then after, when he moved to San Diego, of course, he was out of touch, and so otherwise that probably would have continued.
Yeah. And then when Will went down to San Diego, he gave the board down there the condition that he would come down and do it, providing that they hired Robert Erickson to come in along with him and jointly set up the department.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, a little favor in return, and another great move.
Yes.
Down through history.
Sure, and then another. And then I was slated to be the third faculty member down there.
Oh, at San Diego?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Because then they both got together and they were setting up an appointment for me, and they had me come down, and I decided I didn't want to do that. I didn't really want to make a career as a professor. And it was a very hard choice.
Oh, boy.
Because it was a really nice, mm-hmm. a nice offer.
A beautiful meal ticket with really a really worthwhile job attached to it.
Yes, and see, I had grown up in this area. The idea of being a professor at the University of California was a really big thing to me, mm-hmm. and it was like a childhood thing, you know, or something. You know, you'd have this. I mean, that's about as much success as one could imagine, as sort of as when you first hear about it, or even first hear about such things. And I didn't know about East Coast colleges or universities or anything. All I knew that there was this University of California at Berkeley. Yeah. And so,
like a little Catholic boy making it onto the College of Cardinals.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was this big thing. So when I turned it, I remember coming back after, because I just rejected it right at the time when I was down there on this visit, made this decision, said, no, I think I won't do it. And on the plane back, I almost got sick to my stomach, you know, from having what I had done. You know, not that I was going to change anything, but I've done that. So that association has carried through, and we've all been friends all through the years. And I've done projects with them, as with the people at KPFA. So when I did it, when I came back from Paris, I was. Oddly enough, and typically for the time, I guess, hadn't figured out what I was going to do when I got back.
You didn't have to figure out in those days.
Apparently not. Yeah, I'm having real trouble adjusting the current times because of that. You know, is that used to be able to live on the edge of the economy.
Mm-hmm. My friends have had a joke about me for years that I am attempting to set the record as the world's oldest promising young man.
No. And I've hardly had a job to this day, actually, because of that early conditioning. Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't had a job since I left KPFA.
Wow.
That's 1965.
That's damn impressive. So when I returned, I took at the instigation of Robert Erickson, took a position at the San Francisco Conservatory, where he was teaching. Mm-hmm. And so what I was doing in the community was teaching the conservatory, composing my own work. And thinking that there was no vital music scene other than the beginnings of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And at the beginnings of the Tape Music Center, that was not a performance situation, but they were beginning to do performances, but with tape music. I mean, they called it the Tape Music Center, and mm-hmm. they thought that's what they were going to work on, was doing tape music.
Mm-hmm. What precedents did they see themselves as following?
I really don't know. I couldn't say.
I mean, would they have looked towards? Well, I think they would have looked more towards the Cologne school and electronically produced sound.
I don't think it
than,
was
than towards Paris and Musique Concrète.
See, I don't think that it was any of that. Mm-hmm. I think that it was entirely homegrown and done very naively, not mm-hmm. from any historical perspective. We didn't.
I don't think that Henry Jacobs didn't have anything to do with it at all, did he?
No.
Although he had
that, well,
along
if there was a precedent, it was probably Henry Jacobs' precedent.
Okay.
I mean, much more mm-hmm. influential than anything else that would have mm-hmm. come around. I mean, people knew about things that were going on. There were some early things in Europe and some of the things in Stockhausen. And I had been to, I had studied with Stockhausen when I was in Europe and at Darmstadt. And so I was able to bring back some information. Lamont Young had been there a couple years before that, or a year or two before, and brought back tapes and things to us in the community. So some of those ideas were percolating around, but the real the influences were things that came off of what people could, in terms of if there was influence from Europe, it was things that were done on KPFA. So you'd hear what was going on, or things people had brought back from Europe. But mostly, it was pretty much homegrown. It was, in the early stages, Terry Riley and Pauline and Ramon and Morton sitting around, fooling around with tape machines, as everybody was, trying to do a few mm-hmm. things, and then they would gather a few... Mm-hmm. oscillators, and they would put them together and connect them and do these
kinds
of things.
Was Lamont involved at all?
No, because when after he left Berkeley at the same time I did, and he went to New York.
Yeah.
Right. And so, although his influence was strong, it wasn't over a very long period.
Yeah. Because at the time that he and Terry were in the music department at Berkeley, I hadn't come to KPFA yet, and I was in the music library at Berkeley, in charge of circulation and doing some things with the archives and stuff, and I got involved in some of their performance. Experiments. There was a noon concert that the two of them did that I was one of the performers in.
Oh, yeah, I performed in that concert, too.
And there were certain people who referred to, around the music library, who referred to me and Lamont and Terry as the terrible trio. Back when Terry had a crew cut and rode a motorcycle.
Yeah, and that's when Lamont did the piece for Benches and Chairs. And
oh yes, I was a member of the original cast of chair music.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then he and Walter DeMaria were doing things out of doors events around the mm-hmm. same time too.
Yes, and remember Glenn Glasso did the for Hertz Hall a performance of the Cage Imaginary Landscapes for 12 radios. And there was a rehearsal at KPFA.
Yes.
And were you involved in that as
no,
well?
No, but I remember hearing about it because it was
a real caging event because we got into Hertz Hall for the actual performance and we discovered at that point and not before that because of the steel and concrete nature of the building, there was no reception whatsoever. So it turned into a performance of a longer performance of 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Yeah.
Oh God!
So there was this ambiance of people wanting to do something that was not part of the thing is that there were not avenues open for real much experimentation in relation to the Composers Forum, which is one venue, and of course, the symphony orchestra wasn't open to anybody, and let alone even nobody even thought about the opera even being possible, you know, as a concept. And so, what you had to do was you had to create your own musical environment. And so, one of the things that we did was to create an ensemble or an organization, a very loose organization, not incorporated or anything, called Performer's Choice. And we did this with Will Ogden and Dwight Peltzer and myself. And Dwight Peltzer and I did the Performer's Choice part of it, and Will Ogden did the KPFA part of it. And Will Ogden kept a totally unofficial relationship with Performer's Choice, but what we were doing was that the three of us were using the resources of the community to create a new kind of way of making, broadcasting, and presenting new music. And so the first concert that we did, and I have these documents, and I can get copies of this kind of stuff to you. I've got them stored away. We presented something in a little theater at the Berkeley High School or something, and what we started doing was a series of live broadcasts of public concerts. And so the first concert was presented at Berkeley, and the ones after that were done in Golden Gate Park at a place called the Hall of Flowers. Uh-huh. And we were actually able to see, one of the things we did is the style of presenting it was that it was, the programming was always made to include unusual representations of older music. And so on one time I think we had a Adolf Baller playing a Mozart quintet or something that as part of a concert, and then it would have a premiere of a Seymour Schifrin piece for chorus and instruments, and then it would have some other kind of thing. So we tried to do a lot of variety and play, perform music not only from the Bay Area, but a little bit from other, but more unusual things.
I remember the series well because I was on the staff there at the time, and I was involved in some of these in the transmission.
So you probably remember better than I, but at least you had the more of the.
Well,
perspective.
You would remember the music better than I, because I was in the process of being musically educated during this whole period.
So what we did is that somehow informally we just kind of the three of us Dwight Pelzer, Will Ogden, and I decided to create this series of events. And the musicians in the area were perfectly interested in doing that, and we could make enough from the admissions at the door to pay expenses. We never had a grant for it. Mm-hmm. We never had, KPFA didn't pay any money. KPFA mm-hmm. paid for its, you know, pay, had enough expenses just doing the live broadcasting. And KPFA would put announcements in the folio and sometimes a cover of a folio to promote mm-hmm. the event. And we would print up posters and so on. It didn't cost much, and we would always get enough people at the door to pay for it. I know it seems like that's the way concerts mm-hmm. used to be done. And
yeah, exactly. And the,
I mean, back in Mozart's time, you know, and from yeah, you know, like
a collection of composers would get together and perform each other's works, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a question of you know, rehearsal fees and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You just got together and you rehearsed mm-hmm. it as much as you had to get it done.
And but we were able at those times to do it with. I mean, each concert was a union contract.
Oh, you know? Oh, they were. Oh.
Yeah. And there would be the regular, there were rehearsal and, I mean, rehearsal fees and so on. And then the point was that the economy was such that was significant to the musicians, really meant something to mm-hmm. get that much pay. And it wasn't so much that you couldn't get it at the door. I mean, we recently put on an event that was about 2 years ago. I mean, it did have a lot of technology, and it was kind of a research presentation. But we figured out that in order to break even on this thing, we would have to charge $75 a seat. For, you know, mm-hmm. so that's,
you're into the world of grand opera
or something. Yeah. So things of you know of, and of course we couldn't charge that much. So we lost a lot of money on it. But we knew we're going in. That was an investment. It was.
There's one event that I remember. I have a very strong visual memory of, but I don't remember the musical content of it. And maybe you will. It was a KPFA broadcast. It was from Mills College. It was from not from the concert hall, but from. I remember it was a large rectangular open space with a flat floor. You were involved, Ramon was involved, and George Craig and I were both over there on the technical setup, and I think it involved quite a bit of electronic equipment being set up, and I think rather a number of speakers.
Yeah, I think that was, I remember that, and I was involved as a performer,
mm-hmm.
Not on... As I mentioned, see, I was never, other than learning how to set up microphones mm-hmm. in the studio concerts, mm-hmm. I was never really involved on the technical mm-hmm. side.
Yeah, yes, but I remember you and Ramon as two of the performing musicians, but I think others as well whose names I don't remember.
Yeah, well, I think that was an event produced by Pauline Oliveros, and that was when they took the Tape Music Center to Mills. And then she was the director at that point. See, the tape music... So with the period that we were talking about, we were just about getting into the time of the interaction with the Tape Music Center. And then after that was in San Francisco for a while, then it moved over to Mills, and that became the Center for Experimental Music, or whatever they're calling it now.
Yes, there was...
And that was that event.
There was a fairly brief period at Divisadero Street with all of the... With the three elements mm-hmm. involved, Tape Music Center and KPFA and then the Ann Halpern Dance.
Yes. And so what we did is that we first started doing the concert. We did the first concert in Berkeley, and then we did two or three concerts in San Francisco at the Hall of Flowers. We didn't even do series. Mm-hmm. We didn't mm-hmm. really kind of have mm-hmm. the concept.
Yeah.
We would just think of a concert
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. and produce it, pick a date, and produce, and mm-hmm. that would happen. And then sometimes we had some ideas for the next concert, And so, by that time, after the concert, then we would decide what the next one would be. And we just gave them numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So the first concert was, we knew that we really didn't have a plan. So we just gave them what was called Performer's Choice 1. And the idea was, the music is both chosen from the point of view of the performers deciding what they would like to perform, rather than having it come from top down, and from emphasizing improvisation, where the performers decide spontaneously also the details of something.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of Charles Scheer's successful venture and under his period as music director, when he put on the third annual festival of the avant-garde, being the first one, and it was so successful that the following year he put on the third annual festival of the avant-garde.
Yes, well. Charles has even a nicer way of numbers than we had. But then we did ours first, so he wouldn't want to do... He actually had to come in and improve and make a conceptual improvement on that style. Anyway. And so what we did was... And by about that time... The performance aspects of what they were doing at the Tape Music Center were growing and growing, and they were getting more and more performance-oriented. They'd always been performance-oriented because they would play electronic instruments with performers and so on, but they were getting more and more musical instruments involved. And so they were becoming much more like concerts, but theatrical concerts. What our group was doing at the time was to produce mostly non-theatrical musical concerts. Sometimes there would be some theater aspects of the performances. And in a way that worked much better on KPFA for radio broadcast.
There was a major festival I remember over at Divisadero Street that involved John Cage.
Yes.
At one point, which would have been somewhere around 64.
Yeah,
something like
probably
that.
Probably about 64. And the way we got to that was probably the culminating event of the interaction of the sort of like the local the avant-garde music forces at the time. Mm-hmm. We had been developing independently with KPFA, the Performer's Choice, and the San Francisco Tape Music Center had been developing more of an outgoing public presentation style until they acquired this space at 321 Divisadero, where they had a very nice performance space. And then Will convinced KPFA to set up a studio in that space so they could broadcast events there. And then we started doing the Performer's Choice concerts there in that space. Mm-hmm. And then there would be broadcasts of Tape Music Center events and other kinds of events that would go on. And in fact, I think that the acoustical treatment of the space was done by KPFA volunteers,
mm-hmm. yep.
and it was treated mm-hmm. as a remote studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Very another idea.
It was a good sized room. Of course, it had been a Wobbly Hall.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then it was a church
IWW.
Or something. How appropriate.
Yeah. And I think another radical group as well had had it as their as their headquarters. It was an ancient, honorable lineage.
And since we're still, all of us still involved in public performance, we know how much difficult it was to get, I mean, how difficult it is to get resources now. You know? There's something about the economy that I don't understand that's going on. That's been going on for about 20 years now. That
and there's so many miles of red tape you have to go through in having a public event, and if a hall is not approved, and fire exits, access for disabled toilets, there's just an incredible amount of stuff.
Yeah, all kinds of reasons why that couldn't be done. But at that time, it was actually possible for KPFA to have this beautiful radio studio. Mm-hmm. Where you could do public events and performances, and it sounded quite good, and you could make.
I remember KPFA had this little booth with a glass window off to one side, and then also off to one side there was the workspace of the Tape Music Center, and then there was off in that corner and across that way there was the separate, fairly sizable dance floor of Ann Halpern's group. There's a lot of space in that.
And so that,
and imagine the rent that one would pay now for that much space in the middle of San Francisco.
Yeah. So there we were, all these groups coming together, somehow, without any financial resources, particularly. Yeah. I mean, the Tape Music Center was kind of able to raise enough to pay their part of the rent, and KPFA could come in with some part of it.
It's almost like Paris in the 20s. You know, these amazing things could happen without any expenditure of money to speak of.
And it really wasn't too hard to get the little bit of money we needed in those times. And you didn't need much. And so then all these groups kind of formed together to produce this big event, which we called, I think, the Tudor Fest.
Yeah,
because David, we asked David Tudor to come in and sort of be like guest curator or something, and it was the idea of we were going to produce a festival of the kind of music that David Tudor wanted to do, and it was sort of like bringing that influence.
Performer's choice.
Yeah. And so it was a collaboration between Performer's Choice and the Tape Music Center and KPFA, because Will Ogden was always in there working as one of the partners, even though keeping the lines nice and clean. He actually was a marvelous politician, the best politician probably that ever passed through there.
Will because was so... He was such a apparently such a a sort of, one could almost say, dull, respectable little clerk sort of a looking person, thoroughly academic. You'd expect him to be, working on some project on the use of the umlaut in Middle High German or something like that. But by God, the imagination of that man,
and his ability to, his ability to create. What he did. Oh, I know the one that's in heat. See, Robert Erickson knew better than anybody Will's capabilities. And so the way it really worked in San Diego, now as I remember, is that Robert Erickson was asked to form the music department there.
Oh.
And it's just the other way around. He said he would do it, but only with Will Ogden. And the point is, Robert Erickson really didn't have a clue. He was not all that good a politician. He didn't know how to operate, It was, and he knew that if he got Will in there, Will came in and just smoothed over and made the whole system, and that's how they got it going without big upheavals and all the kind of stuff. Because he brought that same quality that he had, of just getting things done. And he's very quiet, marvelous, always totally insightful and completely musical way.
In three or four days, I'm talking to Will.
Yeah.
Down inside the ear.
So that's
And
it'll
be interesting to how his version comes out without any prompting for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, what tends to not come out of histories like this. I mean, I think that was a very, and what I mean by that is that we, the musicians in the San Francisco area, created at that time was a very unique environment that really fed the whole musical environment up until recently. I mean, and now I think that spirit has gotten lost in a way. But new things are coming on that are quite good and not necessary. But we did it in such a way that it was gradually involving and bringing together the resources of the entire community. And we were all of us kind of seeing it and working that way. And I'm kind of jumping around, but what we created at that time was the possibility of doing something like that. And KPFA was essential in the role of developing that. And it started, I think, very much in a very strong way, coming from Will Ogden. That it was his ability to work with all of us as various groups, with him in there at KPFA, and to the way, I mean, it was difficult to work with KPFA because of the lack of money all the time, and plus the fact that they were having all kinds of internal political strife and all that stuff, and so, you know, all that was, so, and so, but just during that short period that Will Ogden was there, he kind of launched a way of really working with the community in a bigger way than ever been done before. Before, there was sort of like support for community and broadcasting events and so on. But that was the point where you really started getting in and taking a hand to getting things started. And he would generate things. I don't even think he let the people at KPFA know that he was involved in generating them. It was sort of like, oh, well, we have the chance to broadcast this, you know. And so the public history is that Will Ogden was there as a broadcaster, you know. But the real history is that he was there as an integral instigator of creating a new musical environment on the West Coast. And this environment has influenced American and European music from that period. The music, the way of performing and the way of creating music and so on. And so that was at a time when in a sense, from our point, we turned it around a little bit so that our people were not looking to Europe or so on, say, but Europe was more looking at us and paying attention to what we were doing. Now there were other things going. I mean, John Cage had, of course, was doing a lot and contributing a lot and freeing up things and so on. And Europe was starting also paying attention to John Cage at that time. And then later, well, also out of that grew the music of Terry Riley, which was very influential worldwide and so on. And so you're looking back on that. You know,
or you trace the ripples of NC and you go on forever.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was just mentioning that we are doing some processing. One of the things that's coming out is performance that of which Terry and I were the music directors and I conducted of NC that we did about 3 or 4 years ago. This is the 25th anniversary, and that's coming out on New Albion, and we're going to process that.
Did KPFA have anything at all to do with the first performance of NC?
I think it was broadcast. It was done at 321 Divisadero. After a while, we stopped even kind of having like. We stopped having performer's choice as an entity. Mm-hmm. Somehow that it had evolved to the point that we would just put on concerts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
We didn't need to have this thing that was identified as a certain series. And so one of the things that was put on, and I don't remember even how that one was produced, but it was probably just that Terry decided, well, he was going to do a performance. And so you get all the people together and you rehearse and you do this performance and it gets broadcast on KPFA and all the people come and buy tickets and there's a big audience and then the whole thing works.
I'll have to ask Will about that and see if he remembers. the more specific relationship of KPFA to that particular
one piece, but
because that's one of those touch points in recent musical history where the more detail one has about it, the better.
Yeah, and the funny thing was is I remember being in the audience there. For some reason, I wasn't one of the performers, which is unusual. And when we did this 25th anniversary performance, we got as many of the original performers back as we could. So we had Warner Jepson and Ramon was playing in it, and so on. And
there isn't that represented on the Columbia CD of NC in that Terry Riley series of CDs that they put out?
No, that's put. That one was produced by Stuart Dempster with a group at Buffalo.
Oh, at Buffalo. Oh, right. Okay.
And so, kind of the culmination of that interaction as a generating force between our various organizations was doing this two or three week festival with David Tudor, where John Cage was there as a guest, and we played a lot of the music, and we had all we were able to put on big performances. Sometimes we'd have 30 players on stage for some of those pieces. And so we had a real community of, for one thing, all as now, they went through a period where composers stopped being able to perform music or something. After that, now they're back into composers can perform again now. And so the younger composer performers are really making their own music in a really nice way. Mm-hmm. It's very much the spirit of what we had created in the 60s. Mm-hmm. We had, just to kind of follow through what that generated, and the importance of KPFA in generating the new music spirit, was that we kept all working together with whatever resources we had. So even after the 321 Divisadero thing was down, and then it was at Mills, then there was activity at Mills that as you mentioned, KPFA was involved in as a broadcaster. But the thing is that you see the KPFA, through Will Ogden, had been also a generator of being able to do that kind of thing later on. Because without that kind of support, the kind of public acceptance. I mean, we would do things and get audiences.
Yeah. There was a positive feedback loop that developed through KPFA, in which the fact of broadcasting and the results of it actually influenced the kind of music that got written and the enthusiasm with which people created.
Because you knew you could do something, it would be performed and appreciated if you did it well, and a lot of people did it well. Mm-hmm. And I know that when we did our first concerts at the Hall of Flowers, we did, at that time, was like the first concerts in the history of the Bay Area anyway, where you could do new music and get 500 to 700 people to come and pay to go to a concert. After that period,
God Almighty,
if you can imagine. Well, and then here I want to point out how this kind of grew. So now I'm kind of getting the historical links in. That then I formed what is now called the San Francisco Conservatory New Music Ensemble. I think we called it at the time Artist Choice. No, San Francisco. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't Artist Choice. It was San Francisco Conservatory.
As New Music Ensemble, you did at least a record or two, didn't you?
That came, yes, but it came after my time. So we formed. It was called the San Francisco Artists Ensemble. And the reason we did that is my own preference. I always chose to not say, for it was like, I had this marketing insight, which was to not advertise that you're doing new music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're doing, my idea was that you were doing music. And I was also working in, working toward doing works with symphony orchestra and so on. And I really liked, and from my own choices, like when we did performer's choice, I always liked having the new mixed with the older music because I liked the broader context. I never really cared much for having all concerts of just new music.
Well, that was always a principle of KPFA concert programming, sure, of the recorded concerts,
yeah,
at the best of times.
And who knows? I mean, maybe that's where I learned that. maybe that came from Alan Rich, you know. And so we started doing concerts at the conservatory that were very much like the concerts of that we'd been doing before, that we were calling Performer's Choice. And then this was this new music ensemble at the conservatory, as it later became known. They changed the name as soon as I left.
I remember one concert. I wonder if this will trigger anything in your brain. A big concert at Devesadero Street, which KPFA broadcast, which involved the use of this strange tape loop based keyboard instrument called something like color organ or something of the kind. It was something that had been developed, I think, as a pop instrument, but everybody got terribly fascinated by it because there were these strips of tape in,
mm-hmm,
and you could play these tape. It was a sampler, a primitive sampler.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I almost remember the name of the organ. Almost, Ramon was in charge of that.
Uh huh.
And Ramon, in fact, every once in a while, Ramon would get me over to the Tape Music Center to try to find something that would attract me to want to participate. And one of the things he wanted to get me to do, or at least that's, I don't know, I'm not sure. But anyway, one of the was to sort of become the person who knew how to program that organ and could be responsible for that organ. And took my look in there and, you know, decided I could never work with that thing. It was way too complicated.
Yeah, the original Rube Goldberg invention, that thing.
It was wonderful. But anyway, Ramon was able, you know, Ramon could work with anything, and he could figure out how to make anything at hand do something musical. And so probably I think the most successful piece that was done with it was the piece that Pauline Oliveros played. And it was Ramon's composition. It was a piece for this organ. And sometimes it was on tape, but at the concerts there, the organ would be played live. They'd start it off, mm-hmm, and Ramon would play it upstairs or something. And I think even they did some of the early performances live. I know when they did NC, Ramon was playing that organ upstairs with headphones on.
Oh my God!
I think I know that. Yeah. Well, where we left off was kind of tracking this influence of KPFA on the new music scene, particularly in the '60s, and then the way that continued to be, that influence grew even though KPFA in many ways kind of started cutting back on its ability to participate in such things. It did increasingly over time become more and more of a broadcaster of events as far as music was going, rather than a generator. But it wasn't so necessary as it was in the early times. And so so we were tracking down Will Ogden's influence through this period of kind of getting this entire activity flowing in a way that it was functional, so that you really could use the interaction, and there was some way of connecting up all of the people in the area, and a lot of it had to do with just people's trust and Will, that everybody could, including the people at KPFA, could have some confidence that he was going to do something sensible, and so they kind of left him alone, and then the musicians, since he's such this fine person, but also this really fine composer and musician himself, there was really easy trust established through a large part of the community. So all of these, so any of the one projects wasn't so much important as the interaction of all the various kinds of projects. So when I talked about this Performer's Choice series, it just went on as long as it was necessary to be that series. And then when it wasn't necessary to do that, we did it another way. And the Tape Music Center evolved much more into a performance facility. And when it changed the mills, it kept continuing the electronics and performance. And so it evolved in various ways, which were, especially in the beginning, there was a lot of participation in terms of KPFA broadcasting the events. So I don't want to jump around too much. So what happened because of this atmosphere that was created? That it was possible for all kinds of new activities to get started out, and there was a place to link in, and so you could so the people could come in, and there was a way of connecting to KPFA to get events started and get recognition for it and get kind of moving on. And so rather than becoming a very well-organized, consolidated system, it was very anarchical. And there was no structure. So that it allowed new things to happen and things to grow. And some of the things that happened because of the way that this was proceeding is that this audience was being built. And there was a real example of audience building, that we always could have an audience. There was not a problem like around very much of the rest of the world with new music, is that there was an audience that would come and pay for tickets and come hear the music and who would listen to it on KPFA, but they would also come out into the performances. And that audience came... What happened just during this time is that then one of the avenues was that I started developing the new music ensemble at the conservatory. And these concerts were always broadcast by KPFA. My idea of doing a concert, how to do a concert, was that you did a concert and it was a live radio broadcast. And it was always, I learned that because when I was at KPFA, that was my job. I did live radio broadcasts, And so it all kind of came, my connection was always there. And so right from the beginning of these concerts, they were radio broadcasts. And we always had the expertise of George Craig from the beginning of the first times of the things we were doing, things with Will Ogden, as George Craig was there through this whole long period of just directing it, keeping it honest and right and sounding good and so on in a very musical way. Also, he was there to record for all of us when we needed a recording engineer that understood how to record difficult music. Mm-hmm. Music was difficult to record. He was able to do all of that. So there was this big support system that was developed, not necessarily organized in any direct way, but very tightly linked by friendships mainly. And so the concerts at the conservatory started growing, building an audience, and for the first time they were the only concerts for many years, and certainly during the 60s, that actually attracted an audience for any of the performance ensembles of the conservatory. that the only thing people would come to hear the conservatory were concerts of new music. And then we started taking these concerts out and performing in different locations and so on, and building on it for that. And then when I left the conservatory, this time to go to Rome on a Rome Prize for 2 years, then let's see. Okay, all during this period, okay, building up, then it's all the connections are first. So then there was, and you get the history straight. I don't remember how it was, but there was Will Ogden, and then I think it was Charles Shearer that came in and worked. Mm-hmm. And so that collaboration kept going. All the, with Charles and George Craig, and all the rest of us in the community at different locations, putting on events and keeping the same kind of energy that we had started out in this one little concert in Berkeley with Will Ogden called Performer's Choice One, which now I remember had a score of mine called Mandala Music on the folio cover. And yes, and that was a thing that sort of back. That helped attract attention to the whole thing. And one of the things that grew out of KPFA was this thing about not being embarrassed by doing new things, you know? And so you could really have audiences. I mean, it's too bad that things like symphony orchestras and so on don't know that these days. They could have learned that, and they could have been building audiences instead of destroying audiences.
Yes. Well, it's when accountants and bookkeepers get their hands on an operation,
yeah, well, I think
you have something else.
In the 80s and 90s, this has evolved in when marketing people get in. I think before it was accountants, you know, mm-hmm. And then they discovered marketing, and so it's gotten so far from music that you've got people there that can't even listen to music, let alone think about reading a score or saying something intelligent about it, you know.
The very idea of minimalism appeals to a bookkeeper because it sounds economical.
Yeah. So what happened is then. And then Howard Hirsch was at KPFA, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. After Charles.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. Quite briefly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I left the conservatory, then Howard Hirsch came in and took over the new music ensemble and changed it to the San Francisco name to the new music ensemble. And I did a similar thing that Erickson had done, that I learned from Erickson about finding people to follow you that will do the good work, mm-hmm. is I told the conservatory management, they always wanted to know what was the skill that I had to get these students to play the way they did, because they would always outperform themselves all the time, mm-hmm. And also, we always had faculty ringers and symphony mm-hmm. ringers when we needed them. But the level of performance was very, very high on the new music area compared to when they'd go out and play regular music. And so they were wondering. So there was this big mystery around the conservatory is what it was that I did, you know, as this director. You know, one of the things I did is that. But I wouldn't ever tell anybody what it was. And one of the things I did was I didn't conduct. And let's see. they never caught on to that. I always had a student conductor. And so I was training people to perform. That's what I was doing, you know. And so it was their own thing. And once something, you know, when people would get, they would, you know, how students could be, I don't want to do this and so on. And so I don't care. Go ahead. My name's not on the program. Your names are on the program. You went, and that was part of my. It was very little of it was musical, but anyway. So I had this strange power at the conservatory to be able to name my successor. Because I said that there are only really right now I can only think of one person who could understand how to do it the way I did it. And certainly, there are only one or two people that I would tell. I would not tell the management of the conservatory how it was done. And so that person was Howard Hirsch. So there's another connection with KPFA. So now Howard Hirsch comes over. Now he's already been working at KPFA. Now he's doing the ensemble. Howard Hirsch was appointed into his position, I think, by Charles Scheer. And so they were always willing to work together. And so they kept going. And Charles would be producing events after he was out of KPFA that would kind of go back in and lead back in. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, when Howard was at running the ensemble at KPFA, I mean at the conservatory, and I don't know who is it. Oh, I know why I didn't know, because I was in Rome at the time, so I have this two-year period gap, which was pretty much the time that Howard did that position while I was gone. And now what Howard did. Howard is like, in addition to being a really fine composer and performer and good radio person and all these other skills that he has, he's like Barnum and Bailey or something, you know. Just a marvelous promoter. Just has his kind. And so he started taking, he just went exponential in the audience response. I should mention also that very much involved as a co-director of that project at that time was Bob Moran.
Oh.
And he was a co-director with me. And then when I left, he was the co-director.
Yes, of course, because this is now well after the time when I was in, when I left Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I then got involved with Bob Moran later on, because he wrote a piece for Nora Post, the oboist. You know her? She was involved.
I know about her, yeah.
She was involved down at San Diego at one point. And he wrote a piece for her for a performance at the Kreinich Steiner Prize concert at Darmstadt. It called, and this caused a whole furor, Survivor from Darmstadt.
Oh, I remember hearing about that.
That great kerfuffle. Yeah. And a piece for pre-recorded tape and bass oboe. And the pre-recorded tape had, I think, five bass oboes on it, plus the one live component. And I did the sound projection for that at Darmstadt.
Oh.
And that's how I met up with Bob Moran. And later again, in I went to New York and visited Nora, and we went to a Bob Moran concert over in the Village, and so met up with him again there. So it's all
so
going
yes, it's pretty interesting. So through his, so he was also, as you know, Bob Moran is quite a showman.
Oh boy!
Okay, now you put those two together. And they were starting to produce events that were at, let's see, we had been doing things, for example, that were in the courtyard of the De Young Museum before. And we get really good audiences. But then when Howard Hirsch took over, he started getting, they became real major Bay Area events. These performances, and they would put them on a couple of nights in a row, I think, sometimes, and there was always a big audience, and everybody would go, and it was a very exciting and very theatrical and really wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. Always, still, broadcast live by KPFA, generally with George Craig,
mm-hmm. Yep,
running the whole show. Now this kept growing through that time. Then the next person that they appointed. And I'm kind of falling down that track to show how this kind of interaction was really able to grow into something. The next person appointed to that position after Howard Hirsch left was John Adams. And John Adams at that time was a complete unknown. Mm-hmm. and just
this was at the conservatory.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I didn't know he'd done that.
So at about this was then therefore would make it around 73 or something or 74. I know when I came back from Rome, I came in and conducted a piece of mine for the New Music Ensemble that was done at the Art Museum in San Francisco, in the very big audience. Anyway, those big. Anyway, so each time that these events would get produced over those years, that it would really grow, and Estelle carried out that same idea that Will Ogden and Dwight Peltzer mm-hmm. and I had started way back on our first mm-hmm. performer's choice, which was in around 62 or 3 or something like mm-hmm. that. And so then John Adams started in, and that whole side, that aspect of it kind of lost ground as far as public acceptance and energy and so on, because he wasn't from the tradition. Mm-hmm. He was brought in from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And so we had a real musical village mm-hmm. at that time, as you saw all these interconnections mm-hmm. and so on. So it was really easy for the next person to go. And so, so this didn't...
It really mirrored what had existed in the poetry scene mm-hmm. in San Francisco.
Yeah.
The San Francisco Renaissance period was really looking back at the 40s, before the East Coast carpetbaggers mm-hmm. moved in, under Kenneth Rexroth. It's just this same kind of a process going on.
Now, the interesting thing that happened, however, pretty much by this time at the conservatory, it had become, that ensemble became really insignificant and of no importance. And it was mainly kind of like another academic new music ensemble where the directors were trading off favors. You play my piece, I'll play yours, and mm-hmm. so on. And the mm-hmm. concerts were really pretty boring, even though they played my music. It was okay, but just was no real significance the way it had been up to that point. But what John Adams started doing, it was a very interesting thing. The point I'm saying, and this is not necessarily, well, it's a criticism of him following up in that position. I mean, somebody else could have made more of that. Mm-hmm. But he started working with the conductor, Ato DeWart, of the symphony. And then they started producing mm-hmm. these new music events.
Mm-hmm. And he became a composer in residence for the orchestra.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So this was a launching pad for his career and for his ideas. But one of his ideas was getting out and bringing this music to this higher level where we had been aiming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it
but
was
in the meantime, or maybe I think it was in the meantime, he had done Shaker Loops with a small ensemble at 1750 Arch under the aegis of Charles Amerikanian, and I think that was before. He went over to the orchestra and then did a bigger orchestra
version. Yeah, probably.
Version of
yeah. And so what they did is that they carried these two, as you say, carpetbaggers. Mm-hmm. They picked up on the ideas that were in the community and started doing new music with the orchestra and with the actual conductor of the San Francisco Symphony, Ato DeWart, actually conducting new music at these events. And they built it up so that sometimes the tickets would be sold out. I mean, you had to really make sure you got them, and they would play them in strange performance spaces, not in the symphony hall. They took them out in the community, and so they put them on it at a galleria in the fashion district or something for a while, and then they put them wherever they put them, there was a really good response and real audience participation, and I think there's you might want to know if there's a, I think these were broadcast on KPFA. But there's, but I don't want to, that's something you need to find out, mm-hmm. if that connection continues. But anyway, the spirit of performing new music on a larger and larger and larger scale really did evolve into something very magnificent by that point. There was a lot of enthusiasm for it, you know, and including a time where one of the pieces that we had tried to produce at the conservatory with Bob Moran, that was a little bit, it was beyond us, so we didn't quite get it together, so we didn't produce it, was produced with Ato DeWart conducting and Bob Moran being the soloist.
Oh, my God.
You know, with a big, huge audience and so on. So this was really special, wonderful events. And just briefly to follow and summarize that track, I did, sort of sounding like lack of appreciation, I'm sure, to John Adams, point out to him that this is all really great, but the thing is, you have not made the connection yet with the symphony, because they aren't playing these things on, this is not part of the regular symphony program. These are special mm-hmm. events. You know, until the spirit gets right into the symphony program,
mm-hmm. yeah,
it's not going to be meaningful.
What at the BBC they call the new music ghetto.
Yeah. And so, indeed, it did turn out that the end of John's tenure there, that he said on, in summary, that his one disappointment was that he wasn't able to get it as a real part of the symphony program, as successful as it was. And the proof of that was that when he left, then they brought in the carpetbagger of all times, who was Charles Warrenin. And I think they brought in purposely with the idea of destroying the program, and which he certainly did. He in collaboration with whoever else there at the symphony, who started producing concerts that the people didn't care about, and so on. And so for the first time, pretty soon you got people saying, you know, reviewers, everybody saying, you know, well, you know, went to another one of those, and it's boring, and the audience started going down. Mm-hmm. And to this point, and then they went through this series of some other people, and to this point, they've cut out that whole program.
Yeah. And now, when John Adams was there, they did the harmonium, didn't they? That massive Emily Dickinson setting, because it was certainly recorded there.
Yeah, they did a number of his pieces were introduced there. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's that one on a, you know, big scale, big orchestra, big chorus.
Yeah.
And when I first heard it in recording, I must have, it absolutely blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like it.
And so I think that sort of that reached the high point in that whole transition up through that period of up mm-hmm. through John Adams' tenure with the symphony and so on. It had gotten as high as it could go. And what happened as a result of that, mainly just of, I mean, John Adams couldn't stay there forever, but so we, once he was gone, because he'd picked up on it. I mean, he learned how to function in this environment of doing really creative things, and he did them on a bigger scale than the people before him, you know. Mm-hmm. So he just carried on this tradition of each one going in the bigger and bigger and bigger mm-hmm. scale and so on. And I don't think that there were particular musical compromises or anything. I think it was just that they were really bringing in audiences because they were doing exciting new things. That now, as a lot of us were predicting, when the concert started turning sour, which is with the bringing in of Warren and so on, and then having the conductor of the symphony never participating in the program, for one thing, is they got a conductor who, who was that guy? I guess that was Boomstead. They got a conductor who was probably incapable of doing new music, whether he cared about it or not. So
DeVert was a real sharpie. I mean, intellectually, a very gifted, very intelligent.
Yeah, and he was flashy and a showman, and he seemed to love music and was just trying to experience it all. And so he was perfectly willing to get out there and do it. I mean, before him, Seiji Ozawa had been there. He did a little bit. He did some new music, and he's bringing to the program pretty well. But that was a symphony thing. That was not quite part of this other tradition. I was kind of pointing out how this tradition that came out of this KPFA thing went up in there. And so since then, that tradition is pretty much been demolished, because the problem was is that the San Francisco Symphony Program sort of became the only thing going in town. The conservatory wasn't functioning anymore. Mills was so far out in the boondocks, and that had been through ups and downs and so on. And so they went, it kind of, after Pauline left there, pretty much the audience attention to that kind of went down. And the thing that we had, that we understood at the beginning, probably through the interaction with Will Ogden, was you had to build an audience. And that was the whole KPFA thing, which is you got to build an audience. You got these, get these subscribers. You got to get, somebody's got to pay for this stuff, right? And so maybe all that came out. So that influenced this whole way of thinking, which had not existed in the new music world before. You know, was this and so on. So then you'd have to get somebody else. I see a different kind of thing going on at KPFA now, over the last when this other sort of thing started crumbling down. Now there have been all kinds of new ensembles coming up that are getting established and so on, and they're generally broadcast in one way, either by recordings or so on KPFA, and there's an interaction, and they do, and the studio concerts have started up again, and the young musicians are there performing there. They have their tapes played, they do interviews and so on, and there's attention to audiences, and so there is a real musical community that's grown up around KPFA still, and still exists, and it's probably becoming more vital, and will grow up, and that wave will sort of move out again. I see it on the upswing again.
Yeah, it seems to be impossible to kill it.
Yeah,
that place.
And yeah, so I think that's about what I know about KPFA and its influence.
All right. Yeah, well, the time is marvelous, because this is just about to come to the end of another tape.